This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
And I'm Lisa Loving, KBOO Evening News Director. This week, we are starting a process of tinkering with our evening news broadcast. We're running free speech radio news produced out of Berkeley, California, in its entirety, followed by the locally produced KBOO Evening News. We'd like to know what you think about the broadcast. Please email me at pmnews@kboo.org or call 503-231-8032, extension 203. Change is a process. Listen and get back to me. Do you like it? Do you hate it? Let me know. 503-231-8032, extension 203. Thanks and stay tuned.
This is Free Speech Radio News. It's Wednesday, the 11th of January, 2006. From the studios of KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado. On Capitol Hill, Samuel Alito faces another round of questions in his confirmation hearing for Supreme Court Justice. With Ariel Sharon's departure from politics, we'll hear Israeli perspectives for peace in the region. And we'll hear from Sydney, where environmentalists are critiquing a so-called climate conference. These stories and more after these headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The Bush administration and the government of British Prime Minister Tony Blair have both made statements indicating that the United Nations Security Council will take up the matter of Iran's decision to resume nuclear activity. This comes the day after Iran angered Western leaders by breaking the UN seals at a nuclear research facility. Even Russia, usually an ally of Iran in international disputes, has voiced concern about the move. Tehran claims the research is to generate electricity, while many Western countries fear the research will be used to develop nuclear weapons. Tony Blair today told Parliament that the British, French, and German foreign ministers will discuss the issue tomorrow in Berlin. A former Argentine Navy officer will face trial in Spain for crimes against humanity. The ex-military official worked at Argentina's infamous ESMA clandestine detention center, where thousands of activists were tortured and murdered. Marie Trigona reports from Buenos Aires.
A Spanish court has charged a former Argentine Navy officer with human rights abuses during Argentina's military regime in the 1970s and 80s. A leading prosecutor argued yesterday that Ricardo Miguel Cavallo should be sentenced to as many as 17,000 years in prison if convicted. The former Navy lieutenant has been charged with genocide and multiple counts of murder and terrorism. The charges stem from the years when he worked at the ESMA Navy Mechanic School in Buenos Aires, which was used as a clandestine torture center. At least 5,000 of Argentina's 30,000 disappeared were murdered at the ESMA detention center between 1976 and 1983. Cavallo, in Spanish custody since his 2003 extradition from Mexico, could be tried in Madrid before the end of the year. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Marie Trigona in Buenos Aires.
With the use of DNA evidence increasing while some states are questioning the use of capital punishment, a case before the Supreme Court could affect how DNA evidence can be used to exonerate prisoners. Darby Hickey has more from Washington, D.C.
As the confirmation hearings of Supreme Court nominee Samuel Alito continue to block away, the current Supreme Court heard oral arguments this morning regarding a Tennessee death row inmate who claims DNA evidence proves his innocence. Paul Gregory House was convicted of murder and sentenced to death in 1985, a crime House says he did not commit. A link between House and some evidence at the scene has been called into question by DNA testing, but the prosecution says the evidence is not strong enough to warrant a new trial. Nina Morrison of the Innocence Project, an organization that filed an amicus brief in the case, says the court's ruling could impact how DNA evidence is used to exonerate death row prisoners.
What we do know is that most of the time, claims like this don't ever get to federal court, because when a person's claim of innocence is as strong as Paul House's is, usually the prosecutors just agree to give him a new trial. And in this case, they are holding out and insisting that an innocent man really committed the crime, and that's why it got all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court.
On Tuesday, the New Jersey legislature voted for a moratorium on the death penalty. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Darby Hickey in Washington, D.C.
The 14 protesters charged with unlawful assembly during the World Trade Organization protests in Hong Kong appeared in court today. FSRN's Dante Tosa was at the hearing and files this report.
At today's hearing, prosecution dropped charges against 11 of the 14 protesters for lack of evidence. The three remaining protesters, all Korean farmers, will face trial in March. One is charged with unlawful assembly, while the other two are charged with unauthorized assembly. Both offenses are punishable by a maximum sentence of 5 years in prison. The legal defense team for the farmers say there's evidence that indicates two of the accused were absent from the scene during the time of the alleged offense. The three farmers are free to return to Korea after their release on $4,000 bail. Pre-trial review is set for February 6th, and the three are due back in court on March 1st. From Hong Kong, this is Dante Tosa for Free Speech Radio News.
Israel has withdrawn support for a proposed biblical theme park project led by televangelist Pat Robertson. The day after Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon suffered a massive stroke, Robertson said on television that the stroke was a sign of divine retribution for last year's disengagement from the Gaza Strip. The Christian Heritage Center theme park was a tentative project in which the Israeli government was to allocate a sprawling tract of land along the shores of the Sea of Galilee. The televangelist was to lead the effort to raise $50 million for the park's construction. Today's edition of the Jerusalem Post quotes tourism ministry spokesman Ido Hartov as saying, "We reconsider the deal and realize that we cannot sign with Robertson or with anyone who supports his views." Hartov was careful to leave open the possibility of collaboration with other evangelical groups, critical of Robertson's comments. I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
Samuel Alito has faced the third day of confirmation hearings on Capitol Hill, where he once again defended his decisions during his 15 years on an appeals court against charges that he often ruled in favor of those in power. Alito has also continued to scuttle questions on his stand on abortion. Yame Shea reports from Capitol Hill.
Senator Dick Durbin, Democrat of Illinois, says Alito's judicial record suggests individuals could hardly get a fair chance with Judge Alito.
It's a recurring pattern. The crushing hand of fate here seems to always come down against the workers and the consumers and in favor of these established institutions and corporations.
In 2001, Alito ruled against an African-American man, James Riley, in a racial discrimination case. Riley was convicted of capital murder by an all-white jury. Before trial, the prosecutor had struck all three black candidates from the jury pool. Riley cited the fact that the prosecution had struck every black juror candidate in three other capital murder trials in the prior year. Alito says he struggled over this case and decided statistics alone could not prove discrimination.
And statistics is a branch of mathematics. And there are ways to analyze statistics so that you draw sound conclusions from them and avoid erroneous conclusions from them. Sometimes when you see a pattern, it's the result of a cause. And sometimes when you see something that looks like it might be a pattern, it's the result of chance.
Republican Senator Orrin Hatch of Utah dismisses Democrats' charge that Alito appears more likely to side with the establishment.
It's easy to cherry pick these cases and find a sentence here you don't like and a sentence there you don't like and criticize you for in the process as though you're not being fair, when in fact everybody who knows you knows your impeccable reputation for fairness, dignity, decency and honor and capacity.
Democratic Vermont Senator Patrick Leahy, vice chairman of the committee, asks Alito whether the president could authorize intelligence agencies to conduct secret operations when the statutes prohibit him to do so. Alito gives this answer.
He has to follow the Constitution and the laws of the United States. He has to take care that the laws are faithfully executed. If a statute is unconstitutional, then the president, then the Constitution would trump the statute. But if a statute is not unconstitutional, then the statute is binding on the president and everyone else.
Democratic senators praise O'Connor as a model justice, but Alito refuses to box himself into O'Connor's mode.
Every Supreme Court justice is an individual. I think every nominee is an individual, and no nominee can ever be a duplicate of someone who retires, and particularly when someone retires after such a distinguished career and such a historic career as Justice O'Connor, nobody can be expected as a nominee to fit that mold. If I'm confirmed, I'll be myself. I'll be the same person that I was on the Court of Appeals.
Right outside of the hearing room, the battle over the nomination wages on. Jamie Raston, a constitutional law professor at American University, is one of 600 law professors urging the Senate to reject Alito.
This nominee, whose career has been identified very closely with the executive branch, who has dissented on the right more than anybody else in this circuit, is being sent up by the government to be the pro-authority, pro-government, pro-wiretap, pro-expansive search warrant justice.
Eric Spahn is a member of the organization called RightMarch.com. He comes all the way from Georgia, wearing a sticker saying A+, which is the grade he assigns to Alito.
He has been proven to be a fair judge, one who is not, contrary to the left's claims, that he is just a right-winger with an agenda. He has proven not to have an agenda.
Tomorrow, several judges who worked with Alito will testify in front of the committee. Chairman Spector arranged their appearance. I'm Ye Meixie at Capitol Hill.
Kashmir is facing one of its chilliest winters with heavy snowfall while temperatures continue to drop drastically. As Shahnawaz Khan reports from Srinagar, a scarcity of fuels in Indian-administered Kashmir's quake zones is adding to the survivors' hardship.
It has been 3 months since a killer quake struck Kashmir and other parts of South Asia, and the survivors are already facing a tougher challenge, winter. Kashmir is currently in the midst of one of the coldest winters in recent years. The famous Dal Lake in Srinagar has partially frozen after 2 decades. The last time the lake had frozen was in 1986. The sub-zero temperatures are exacerbating the harsh living conditions for the people in the quake-affected areas of Kashmir. Salim Ahmad is a resident of Uri, one of the quake-affected area in Indian-administered Kashmir.
If we start counting the problems we have, they are plenty. But right now the point is that our people are living outside in tin sheds, in areas where temperatures are 5 degrees or more below freezing. The tin sheds are no good for this weather, but the houses that are partially damaged are not safe for living.
Salim is also a member of the Central Relief Coordination Committee set up by the NGOs Voluntary Association Network Kashmir and Confederation of Voluntary Associations Hyderabad. This weekend, the groups urged the government to provide firewood and other fuels to people in the quake-damaged region.
We need fuel to keep ourselves warm. We urge the government to provide enough firewood and cheap fuel like kerosene so that we can have the means to fight the biting cold. And if we do not get these, then I think there could be many more casualties than what the toll was from the earthquake alone.
Locals say a few people have already died because of cold weather. The harsh weather has also created health problems in the region. Hilal Ahmed Butt is an aid worker with Save the Children.
If you go to Uri LDH, the sub-regional hospital, you'll find that it's jammed with patients, and most of them are children and women. And these patients are, again, the victims of the cold weather. Like, they have chest problems, and the problems like running nose, fever.
Bone-chilling cold is not the only problem. Hilal says many tin sheds collapsed in the heavy snowfall last week. Accumulation of snow on roads and hilly paths makes it difficult for people to make to hospitals and other places. The snowfall also triggered fresh slides, creating hurdles for transportation in the hilly region and blocked access to some villages scattered over the area. The government had constructed some prefabricated sheds after the quake. But as Hilal says, the number of these sheds is very limited.
The fabricated sheds are really, they are better than what we have there or what is the traditional way of having housing arrangement. But then they are very limited. You'll find that prefabricated sheds, they have been constructed at different villages. But that is, they have made a sort of community residential thing, which actually nobody is using at the moment.
Hilal says all the resources from aid organizations and the government need to be mobilized to protect people from exposure to harsh winter. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Shahnawaz Khan.
The Israeli political system has undergone an extraordinary shakeup in the last 2 months, with the country witnessing not only the formation of a new major centrist party, Kadima, but now the man at its helm, Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, has effectively stepped out of politics due to a stroke. FSRN's Erica Voles gets this Israeli perspective on what impact Sharon's departure will have on future prospects for peace with the Palestinians.
While some Palestinians have personally welcomed the political demise of Sharon, there has been much pessimism over whether any new player will improve the prospects for a peace deal with Israel. However, within the Israeli peace activist movement, while many would not have personally wished illness on Sharon, nevertheless, they see it as an opportunity for a renewed push at peace. Danielle Ophir is the Jerusalem head of pacifist activist group Peace Now.
I think that Sharon was a very big obstacle for peace. Even though he made the disengagement from Gaza, he didn't have an objective of reaching peace with the Palestinians. And that's why his stepping out might open new possibilities.
Despite the shock departure of Sharon as the head of the new centre party, Kadima, pre-election polls show the party may still receive as many as 40 mandates, or seats, out of a total of 120 at the March 28 election. This could make it the party able to form government. Yuri Dromi is a political analyst with the Jerusalem-based Israel Democracy Institute and a former spokesperson of Yitzhak Rabin. He believes Kadima's new leader, Ehud Olmert, Sharon's former right-hand man, has the capability to consolidate this position and push the peace agenda further than Sharon would have.
Ehud Olmert is a very capable politician. He's been around for 30 years in the Knesset. He held top ministerial positions. He was twice the mayor of Jerusalem, which is the most difficult city in the world. And also he is a decision maker. I mean, he can make tough decisions. He also is bold in expressing his views. If you remember, he even preceded Sharon in expressing his ideas about the need to pull out of Gaza.
While Yuri believes Kadima's share of the vote may drop without Sharon at the helm, he says its platform of unilateral disengagement, pulling out of some of the occupied territories without peace talks, has captured the attention of Israel's voters.
The truth is that Kadima, with Sharon or without Sharon, really fulfills a urge or a need or desire by the Israelis for normalcy, for the center, which was lost to the radicals from both left and right. So I think Kadima still, whether or not they'll have 40 mandates is another thing, but I think they'll be a strong party, maybe the biggest party.
Israel's proportional representation system means coalitions with other parties are a necessity. Danielle Ophir with Peace Now believes the best chance for real negotiations with the Palestinians lies in a Kadima coalition with Labour and other left-wing parties. Labour is currently the only major party with peace negotiations formally on its agenda. In contrast, the other major party, the right-wing Likud, remains supportive of building Israeli settlements in the West Bank. Danielle remains concerned that as Kadima has currently not stated its opinion on the really tough issues, such as the fate of Jerusalem and some settlements in the West Bank, it needs a partner like Labour to keep it on track.
And that's why it is important that in this election, more Israelis would vote the left-wing parties, that even not as prime ministers will be able to affect the political way.
This is Erica Voles reporting from Jerusalem for Free Speech Radio News.
As suicide bombers continue to target both military personnel and civilians in Iraq, the U.S. military is continuing to implement a new tactic in the country's occupation. A village in northern Iraq is now the testing ground for Operation Verdun, where U.S. military bulldozers are building a 3-meter-tall wall of sand intended to block entry and exit from Al-Sinia, an area where U.S. troops have seen high numbers of casualties in recent weeks. Salam Talib and Eliana Kaya have more.
Villagers watched from rooftops as U.S. military bulldozers heaved a wall of sand into snaking lines around their homes Saturday in an apparent attempt to trap insurgents believed to be hiding among them. Spanning 10 kilometers and broken by watchtowers to be manned by Iraqi security forces, the crude 3-meter-tall barrier is the army's latest tool to rout out insurgents. Faris al-Azawi, an Iraqi journalist, wrote about the wall in the Iraq for All news website.
We wrote about Al-Saniya village, which is located up in Beji city. It seems that they are trying to copy the security around the green zone in every city in Iraq. And these walls are a kind of security that is just like an American base. So we can say that they are trying to make every small village like a military base. This is part of their plan, to build military bases all around Iraq.
The U.S. Army said it told the village of the operation just hours before it began, and planned to broadcast Arabic messages over loudspeakers until the wall is complete. Dubbed Operation Verdun, after a famous World War I battle, the 3rd Brigade decided to blockade the village after calling it a staging point for attacks. A U.S. Army official said construction is expected to last several days. Captain Christopher Judge, in charge of the operation, said the wall's purpose in Al-Saniya, quote, is to separate insurgents from the population, end quote. But journalist Al-Azawi spoke about the pattern of isolating villages.
It looks like the Israeli project in Gaza, where they try to surround them with walls. And it is the same as building concrete walls around Baghdad. If you take a close look at it, you will find, from an aerial view, that Baghdad now looks like a city of walls. Concrete fences are everywhere, just like Quds and Gaza. They will make IDs for all the residents in the village, block all the gates providing access to the village, ask people the purpose of their travel each time they enter or exit the village, and they will not allow anyone to get out of the village or enter the village after 9 p.m. It seems to be a new policy to punish the areas where the people are resisting the occupation.
Similar walls have been built around Fallujah and Samarra in recent months. Army commanders in Samarra said the number of attacks dropped drastically after an 18-kilometer barrier was built around that city. Al-Azawi compared the operation to building a kind of concentration camp.
They punish people by affecting them economically. The merchants will not be able to get their goods in or out of the village. The farmers will not be able to get their vegetables and fruits to the city. And they are destroying all of the soil and the environment around the village from all the sand. And it will damage the psychology of the people because they will feel as though they are living in a big prison. We heard that the Americans would bring democracy and freedom. This is totally against freedom. When they build a big wall around you, doesn't that make you feel like you are in a jail? If you come from West Iraq to Baghdad, you will see big concrete walls, barbed wire, watchtowers, and hundreds of surveillance lights around the American bases. And all the electricity for these lights is coming from Iraqi sources, while Iraqis need it in their homes. If they were to give this electricity to the houses, the Americans would never need all the security around them, because people will light them and never attack them.
With Salam Talib, this is Eliana Kaya for Free Speech Radio News.
Some of the world's biggest polluters met in Sydney, Australia, to kick off a two-day conference to discuss global warming today. The Asia-Pacific Partnership for Clean Development and Climate, led by the United States and backed by Australia, also includes India, China, and South Korea. Environmental groups are concerned that this new membership will undermine the Kyoto Protocol, especially because the terms of the partnership do not require member countries to set targets for reducing emissions and in fact promote so-called clean coal solutions. The new partnership aims to halve greenhouse gas emissions by the end of the century, but as FSRN's Cinnamon Napard reports from Sydney, environmentalists say this may just be too late.
Not far from Sydney's Central Business District, the delegates from six countries met at a hotel to discuss the issue of climate change, while across the road, environmental groups gathered to protest what they see as a US-led sabotage of the Kyoto Protocol. Over to John Kay, convener at the New South Wales Greens Climate Action Working Group.
The United States and Australia have stood apart from Kyoto. They refused to sign it.
And what they're doing with this is trying to undermine the whole future of collective global international agreements to reduce carbon dioxide emissions. And that's not surprising given that they're the worst two global per capita emitters of greenhouse gases.
Heading the American delegation is Jim Connaughton, chairman of the White House Council on Environmental Quality. Speaking on Australian Public Radio, he's adamant that although coal is problematic, it's still the main way forward.
It is one of the biggest polluters. So the task ahead of us, and it's one which we take on with great zeal, is the task of cleaning up coal and finding the technology path that will produce zero emission coal.
Environmentalists like John Kay remain deeply sceptical about this proposition.
As a person who's a former coal miner, I can tell you there's nothing clean about coal. It's purely a public relations spin to allow countries like Australia to continue to export coal and to make a lot of money out of it.
However, Jim Connaughton argues that coal is necessary for the future.
We need to continue coal as part of our diverse energy supply because coal is affordable. If you look at China, people are coming out of poverty by using coal.
Campaigns manager for Greenpeace Australia Pacific, Danny Kennedy, refutes this argument, pointing out that countries like China are already investing in renewable energy sources.
They've recently committed to a 30 gigawatt wind power target by 2020, which will actually dwarf what they get out of the nuclear sector. So the truth is, the green, clean technologies are coming. And this is the last gasp of the addict.
It remains to be seen what effects this new partnership will have on the Kyoto Protocol, and indeed on reducing greenhouse gases and climate change. For Free Speech Radio News in Sydney, I'm Cinnamon Nippard.
Recent revelations that plainclothes police officers infiltrated planning meetings for a New Year's parade has citizens in Santa Cruz, California, infuriated. As FSRN's Vinnie Lombardo reports, nearly 100 people turned out last night at the Santa Cruz City Council meeting to express their outrage.
It's not a surprise, but at the same time, when it happens at the local level, you can't help to feel shocked and hurt.
Rico Thunder is one of about two dozen unorganizers of last night, a do-it-yourself New Year's parade created by Santa Cruz citizens after the city-sponsored first night celebration was canceled due to lack of funds. Thunder says the group was immediately suspicious of two surfer dudes attending their meetings.
They used fake email addresses, fake phone numbers. There was no listing for any last name of the names that they were given. And then we made some inquiries, and a source within the police department confirmed that there were undercover plainclothes officers at our meetings.
But Thunder says they did more than just observe.
They participated in meetings, they made suggestions, they asked questions, they took on significant commitments, and even helped set the time, date, and location of the following meetings.
Santa Cruz Police Lieutenant Rudy Escalante commented in published reports that spies were sent in to ensure public safety. But Sherry Connable, who marched in the last night peace contingent on New Year's Eve, says that's just smoke and mirrors. She believes organizers were being profiled.
There were avenues for the police to get the information they felt they needed. They didn't explore those avenues. You know, they decided instead to do a spy operation, to sort of do what looks to me like a Department of Homeland Security action here in Santa Cruz. And to me, that's very disturbing.
Santa Cruz Mayor Cynthia Matthews declined to comment for FSRN, but addressed the issue at the start of last night's council meeting.
Although it was perfectly appropriate for representatives of the police department to attend that meeting, there have been legitimate questions raised about certain aspects of what took place. And I want to let the public know that the chief of police has opened an internal affairs investigation into these issues.
Once the police investigation is complete, the city's public safety committee will brief the city council on its findings, a process Thunder says is nothing but a whitewash.
It's not an investigation of police misconduct. It was decided at the highest levels of the Santa Cruz police that they were to infiltrate this group. So they're going to do an investigation and find out that the plainclothes officers did exactly what they told them to do.
Mark Schlossberg, Police Practices Policy Director of Northern California ACLU, says it's possible the police surveillance was illegal. He is assisting local activists in filing a Public Records Act request, seeking any notes, recordings, or photos the plainclothes officers made.
It's in the best interest of the department to release as much information as possible, as soon as possible, to try and allay community concerns and to develop a positive way to move forward from an incident like this.
Vinnie Lombardo, FSRN, Santa Cruz.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. I'm Aura Bogado.
We're proud to be here with our allies in the fight for affordable health care.
I'm Andy Seaton, KBOO News.
For KBOO in Portland, I'm Julie Sabatier.
KBOO's Afifa Ahmed Shafi reports.
I'm Stephanie Potter, KBOO News.
KBOO's Eduardo Delanderos Tiere has more.
I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta.
This is Maddie Bowden.
I'm Alex Collins.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, tonight Benton County residents are coping with more flood warnings.
Old-growth activists are celebrating a new court decision to protect the future of the Pacific Northwest forests.
And we'll have a report on a new toxic car study.
And then the human cost of occupation in Iraq. As of today, there have been 2,210 officially acknowledged deaths of American soldiers, with as many as 48,000 others wounded. IraqBodyCount.org reports 31,348 civilians have been reported killed by military intervention in Iraq. Last year, the medical journal The Lancet reported as many as 194,000 civilian casualties, not counting Fallujah, since the invasion. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, January 11, 2006. I'm Noah Eaton.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. Defenders of the Pacific Northwest natural habitat are celebrating, thanks to a recent court decision to protect the future of the region's forests. KBOO's Doug Guidi has the story.
The Bush administration took a hit with its plans on the continued elimination of the protection of old-growth forests in and around the Pacific Northwest. On Monday, U.S. District Court Judge Marsha Peckman declared the Bush administration's elimination of safeguards of old-growth forests illegal. The Bush administration attempted to eliminate the survey and manage standard along with other safeguards as part of a settlement agreement with the logging industry over a lawsuit logging interests filed in 2001. Before a judge could rule on the merits of the case, the Bush administration agreed to the demands of the logging industry. Rolf Scar is campaign director of the Southern Oregon-based Siskiyou Project, a local grassroots group based in Cave Junction and one of the plaintiffs in the case.
Basically, what this ruling was about was a component of the Northwest Forest Plan, which is called the Survey and Manage Protocols. The idea is very simple. You don't have to be a policy wonk to understand it. You simply need to look before you log in terms of rare and sensitive wildlife. So if the government's deciding to log public lands, they at least need to check out to see what's out there on the ground before they go ahead and clear-cut, especially older and old-growth forests.
The environmental protection groups are expecting some pro-timber groups to appeal Judge Peckman's decision. The rare and uncommon species protected by the survey standard live primarily in old-growth forests. Of the 144 timber sales planned by the Forest Service and the Bureau of Land Management implicated in the ruling, one half would have logged old-growth forests. The Northwest Forest Plan was declared to be legal in 1995 in part because the Survey and Management Standard gave federal officials some assurance that wildlife in the forest would be adequately protected from logging. The Northwest Forest Plan was adopted in 1994 to protect spotted owls, wild salmon, and over 1,000 other species that call the old-growth forests of the Pacific Northwest home. The plan only applied to federal lands. This victory is sensitive to the Siskiyou Project, which saw the devastating effects of the Biscuit Fire of 2002 and the quick decisions of the Bush administration to clear those lands. Rolf Scar.
The Biscuit Fire, you know, was a natural event. This region is certainly no stranger to fire. It's part of what makes it so diverse. But the Bush administration, of course, has used fire to create sort of a sense of urgency and fear that they hoped would just allow them to push this anti-forest, anti-conservation agenda. It's starting to unravel, and I think we're starting to see that.
It's not the first time Judge Peckman has taken sides with environmental advocates. In August of 2005, Judge Peckman ruled that federal land managers broke the law when they failed to study whether species would be protected enough if the administration scrapped a look-before-you-log rule that had governed millions of acres of Northwest forests. I'm Doug Guidi, KBOO News.
Tonight, residents of Benton County are on the alert for more floods. KBOO's Aaron Yankee has a story.
With heavy rains and flooding forecasted, Benton County officials are giving away emergency sandbags and other supplies to guard against stormy weather. Benton County has already experienced flooding in local waterways like Mary's River, which is expected to rise above flood levels this afternoon. Benton County Public Works has free sand and bags available next to its Avery office building located off Avery Boulevard. Community members may call Public Works at 541-766-6821 for additional information. Philomath Public Works also has sandbags available at its office, 1515 Willow Lane, Philomath. For additional information, contact Philomath Public Works at 929-3579. The City of Corvallis is offering sandbags at numerous locations, including Benton County Fairgrounds, Harding School, and Grant Avenue Baptist Church, among other locations. Call Corvallis Public Works at 766-6916 for the nearest location. Private property owners are advised to consider sandbag placement carefully and work with neighbors so as not to shift flooding to a neighbor's property. Local residents should also monitor local media and the National Weather Service at www.weather.gov/Portland. Benton County road closure information is available at www.co.benton.or.us/PW. Property owners needing to add any new riprap, remove gravel bars, or any action moving a stream channel need emergency authorization from the Oregon Department of State Lands. Approval is not needed to repair existing riprap or dikes or to reconstruct roads damaged by high water. To obtain an expedited permit or for more information, property owners should call DSL during regular work hours at 503-378-3805. During non-business hours and on holidays, call Oregon Emergency Response at 1-800-452-0311. For additional information, go to www.oregonstatelands.us. I'm Erin Yankee, KBOO News.
The parties in a class action lawsuit against Portland General Electric reached an agreement yesterday. PGE will refund customers who paid the Multnomah County business income tax as a line item on their bills over the past 7 years. The utility will repay $10 million to fund 7 years of refunds, plus 9% interest, the cost of issuing the refunds, and the plaintiff's attorney's fees. The settlement is not final until it is approved by the Multnomah County Circuit Court. The settlement contains no admission of liability or wrongdoing on PGE's part. If it is approved by the court, PGE residential customers with average bills of $73 per month who were county residents for the past 7 years will receive a total refund of $14. Current and former Multnomah County residents who paid the tax as a line item on their PGE bill anytime between 1999 and 2005 are eligible for the refund with interest. Current customers will receive the refund automatically on their PGE bills. The suit was filed in January 2005. PGE stopped collecting the tax in October 2005 and announced plans to issue a refund. PGE has more than 200,000 residential customers in Multnomah County. Schools, commercial customers, and industries will receive larger refunds because the tax charge was calculated as a percentage of each bill.
The Salem-Keizer School District will replace 20 school gym floors that could release mercury vapors as they age. Superintendent Kay Baker announced a decision at a school board meeting last night. District officials closed the gym at Cummings Elementary School after a test detected unsafe levels of mercury. 20 more tests since then recorded no vapors, and the gym reopened today. Tests at 19 other schools detected the presence of mercury at 8, but none was at a level that could cause health problems, officials said. Nevertheless, the superintendent said she has decided the floor should be removed. Cost estimate is around $50,000 per floor, not including the price of toxic materials removal. The district began testing the 3M tartan synthetic flooring in the fall after the Oregon Department of Education warned that the floors installed between 1950 and 1970 could release mercury vapors as they age or deteriorate.
A nationwide study by the Ecology Center of the Oregon Environmental Council gives new insight into the ways that new cars smell. The study is called Toxic at Any Speed, Chemicals in Cars and the Need for Safe Alternatives. KBOO's Sheila Whiteside has more.
A study released today revealed that drivers and passengers may be exposed to certain toxic chemicals inside their cars. The study found that pollution levels inside cars were 5 to 10 times higher than those found in homes and offices. Since the average American spends more than 1.5 hours in their car every day, this is a major source of air pollution. The chemicals are PBDEs, used as fire retardants, and phthalates, used to soften PVC plastics. Both are partly responsible for the unique smell new cars have. They are found in dust and windshield film samples. They are used in a range of auto parts, including seat cushions, armrests, floor coverings, and more. Drivers and passengers can be exposed through inhalation and contact with dust. PBDEs and phthalates have been linked to birth defects, impaired learning, liver toxicity, premature births, and early puberty in laboratory animals, among other serious health problems, researchers said. The study found that these chemicals are rapidly released from plastics inside cars when exposed to high temperatures. Cars sitting in the sun can easily reach up to 192 degrees. There is no legislation banning the chemicals' use on federal level. At least 9 states have passed laws banning 2 forms of PBDEs. Oregon is one of those states. The report says drivers can minimize their exposure to these toxins by decreasing the heat inside vehicles. The Japanese Auto Manufacturers Association recently announced a voluntary agreement of its members to reduce use of the contaminants. There are so far no plans in the works for American manufacturers to do the same. I'm Sheila Whiteside, KBOO News.
Stay tuned for independent native news following our newscast. Then at 6 p.m., hear Hole in the Bucket. At 7, it's nonstop hip-hop with DJ Audio. Tonight's weather, mostly cloudy with a chance of showers, lows around 40. Tomorrow, rain, highs around 50. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News, Portland, Corvallis, Vancouver, and Hood River.
Tuesday's Measure 37 hearing in the Oregon Supreme Court played to a packed house of activists and developers. The Property Rights Initiative, which voters upheld in November 2004, was thrown out by a Marion County judge. It's now on appeal. The measure guaranteed new development rights or government payments when land use rules limit property values. It also threatened to bankrupt counties and state agencies. KBOO's Lisa Loving spoke with correspondent Michael Papadopoulos earlier today about the hearing.
Michael Papadopoulos, he's a KBOO correspondent who attended the Oregon Supreme Court hearing yesterday on Measure 37. Tell us what happened, Michael.
Well, this was a very interesting hearing. There's a tremendous public interest in what was going on, and even though the hearing was set for 1:15, by midday, half a dozen persons were picketing the main entrance of a building in pouring rain with anti-Measure 37 signs. And it turned out that these people are all, quote, friends of Yamhill County. And the Supreme Court hearing room was packed by many reporters, by the many attorneys who were arguing the case, and about 15 members of the public. Because it was so small, they arranged an overflow space in the Capitol building just down the road with TV and audio coverage available, and about 100 people attended. And so when I say the issue hinges around public involvement, we go right back to Oregon's land use laws, which were enacted in early 1970s, because whenever land is being used or it's planned to use land, the landowner and the developer on the one hand is involved, and the state government and the local government is involved on the other. But then there are members of the public. And so they crafted the land use laws so that the public had tremendous ability to input what it wanted, what rules were appropriate, whether a particular development was in the public's interest or not. You know, people could say so. And then those same people, even though they didn't own the land, were able to go into appeal proceedings, and they were able to go to the Land Use Board of Appeals and all the rest of it. Well, that didn't sit too well. And the many owner developers thought that the process was basically unfair. And so what happened was that they brought up a initiative measure 37, which was voted for and which was adopted a year or so ago. And what was intended there was to provide a way for persons who owned land which they expected to develop to be allowed to develop it in the way they expected without being blocked by new land use regulations which happened to come in. Now, the issues are strictly constitutional. They're highfalutin. And I'm just going to tell you the three basic issues as I see them, and we'll see if you have any questions. First of all, did the people who were against Measure 37 have the right to bring the claim of unconstitutionality before any court at this stage? The jargon for this issue is called ripeness or justiciability, long word. Next question, very important question from Oregon's point of view. Do the persons entitled to make Measure 37 claims under Measure 37 form a true class, one which has an open membership or open membership standards? Does the enactment of Measure 37 grant a governmental privilege to a favored group which unfavored persons can't join? And this comes under Oregon's Equal Privileges and Immunities Clause. And the final question that was raised, and, you know, here you had seven justices, they were all asking questions, technical-type questions, about how did they fit these three issues. So the final question was, does Measure 37 in fact block the operation of land use regulations for persons who bought property before the provisions were enacted? And could such enactment be made either by initiative of the public or by the government? And those are the issues.
What do you think is the single most important or remarkable part of the hearing that you attended yesterday? Was it the number of people there?
Well, I thought that was very noteworthy. And the other remarkable part is that the people who want the Measure 37 to stick have gone to the trouble of starting a recall proceeding against the judge in Marion County who brought it. And, you know, it's remarkable there that they want to interfere with the judge doing what I think is her legal right, to be right or wrong on her decision as to the measure was constitutional or not constitutional. You know, every time a judge makes a decision that you don't agree with, do you want to recall them? I suppose it depends on how your pocket is affected.
I'm Lisa Loving, speaking with Michael Papadopoulos for KBOO News.
Hood River News reports this week that Hood County could offset some of its operating costs and pursue new economic goals by getting into the renewable energy business. The county is forming a committee to explore available options. Officials are seeking people who either have knowledge or expertise in wind, hydro, or biomass production. County Administrator David Merriweather says small-scale generation of wind or hydropower, 10 megawatts or less, is a prospective source of income. Also under consideration will be a biomass plant. But Merriweather doubts the feasibility of that project. He said the county would have to find an alternate source of salvage wood to keep it up and running. Merriweather says wind turbines could be erected on 30,000 acres of county forest land. Also, property could be acquired along the Hood River to erect a small hydroelectric dam. Merriweather says subcommittees will be formed at a later date to thoroughly research each of these options.
And now, let's take a trip to the lighter side of the news with Noah Eaton.
Come one, come all, to the lighter side of the news. I'm Noah Eaton with another edition of See You on the Lighter Side. We begin this edition with something for all you spaceball lovers out there. Space tourists must be screened to ensure they are not terrorists, according to proposed regulations from the U.S. Federal Aviation Administration. The draft report suggestions aim to prevent a terrorist from destroying a spacecraft or using it as a weapon, but the report has no strict proposals on the health of any would-be space tourists. The suggestions will affect Sir Richard Branson's Enterprise, which aims to launch people into space this decade.
The Federal Aviation Administration, FAA, is attempting to regulate the commercial space industry in a bid to ensure minimum safety standards. It has recommended security checks similar to those for airline passengers, according to the BBC. The FAA also suggests space tourism companies check the global no-fly list from the U.S. Homeland Security Department to exclude potential terrorists. The FAA has so far left any medical requirements in the hands of the tourist, who should decide themselves if they are fit to fly. The draft regulations could come into force soon, as the first space tourists have already made it into low orbit around the Earth without box cutters. So if The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy has taught you all anything out there, it's to have your towel with you at all times.
Ludicrous speed! Go!
And finally, we take you to Albuquerque, New Mexico, where a panel of linguists have decided the word that best reflects 2005, truthiness. Truthiness is defined as a quality of stating concepts one wishes or believes to be true rather than the facts. The American Dialect Society chose the word Friday after a runoff with terms related to Hurricane Katrina, such as Katrina Gate, the scandal erupting from the lack of planning for the monster hurricane. The group of linguists, editors, and academics agreed the most useful word was podcast, which is a digital feed containing audio or video files for downloading to an MP3 player. In a runoff for the most creative word, whale tail, the appearance of a thong above the waistband beat out muffin top, the bulge of flesh hanging over the top of low-riding jeans. Tom Cruise became the first public figure in the contest 16 years to be noted for his influence on public discourse. The group coined the term Cruise-lex to describe such terms as jump the couch and cruise-azy. Jump the couch, meaning to exhibit strange or frenetic behavior, won the best Tom Cruise-related word or phrase. It stems from the actor's antics in May on Oprah Winfrey's couch as he talked about his love for a fiancée, Katie Holmes. Cruise-azy means to exhibit crazy behavior. Other winners included Sudoku, a Japanese number puzzle voted the word most likely to succeed, and Pope Squatting, that practice of registering an online domain that is the name of the new pope in order to profit from it, at least likely to succeed. And there's your lighter side of the news for January 11th, 2006. I'm Noah Eaton. See you on the lighter side.
Evening news for Wednesday, January 11th, 2006. If you have any questions or comments about what you've heard this evening, please call us at 503-231-8032 and leave a message on extension 203 or send an email to pmnews@kboo.org. You're listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM on translator K264AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. You can log on to our website at kboo.fm. Our producer for tonight's newscast, amongst other things, is Noah Eaton. Tonight's audio editor is Rubia Yeaman. Special thanks to reporters Doug Guidi, Sheila Whiteside, and Lisa Loving. Our engineer is Eduardo Delanderos Thierry. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Noah Eaton. Stay tuned for Independent Native News. And coming up tomorrow at 7 a.m., hear the KBOO Morning News. At 7:30 a.m., hear Joanne Bowman host Voices from the Edge Talk Radio. At 9 on the Thursday Radio Zine, the guest is Heather Rogers, author of Gone Tomorrow, The Hidden Life of Garbage. At 9:30, Teresa Mitchell hosts Press Watch, The News You're Not Supposed to Know. At 10, Jim Thompson interviews Maestro Stefan Mende, former conductor of the Portland Opera, along with his wife Edith. At 10:30 on Art Focus, Julie Bernard interviews Annie Dubinsky, assistant director of the 3D Center of Art and Photography. And at 11, it's Democracy Now! This all coming up on KBOO. See ya.
This is Independent Native News for Wednesday, January 11, 2006. I'm Robert Hannon in for Bonnie Sue Hitchcock. Canada is preparing for its first winter federal election in 25 years. It's slated for January 23rd, and political observers say Aboriginal voters may make a real difference in the outcome. The voting follows the dissolution of the Canadian Parliament in late November. As political parties vie for potential voters, the Council of Yukon First Nation Chiefs opened its leadership meeting Tuesday in Whitehorse. Phil Fontaine, the National Chief of the Assembly of First Nations, was on hand to talk about AFN issues. But as Chuck Henry in Whitehorse explains, with the national elections just 2 weeks away, the discussion turned to politics and several key issues, including the residential school settlement that compensates all students of a national boarding school system for Native children, and agreement struck in November during the first minister's meeting in Kelowna, British Columbia.
It was standing room only, as Yukon AFN Vice Chief Rick O'Brien and CYFN Grand Chief Andy Carville introduced Fontaine. There were also chiefs there from the Northwest Territories and Northern British Columbia. The AFN has received responses from all the major political parties to a series of 7 questions. Fontaine wants to know where they stand on the issues of the First Minister's meeting in Kelowna, the residential school settlement, and a political accord reached with Cabinet at a retreat May 31st.
We are looking for a clear and unequivocal statement that describes the full support on the part of the next government for these very important undertakings.
Fontaine says he was pleased with the conservative response to the residential schools question, but was left wanting on the conservative position on Kelowna.
What we are hoping to see was a very firm commitment to the objectives, the targets, and the resources attached to each of the targets.
But Fontaine stresses AFN is a nonpartisan organization, and the main focus of the exercise is to get the Aboriginal vote out January 23rd.
And we can make a real difference. The polls are suggesting we're going to have another minority government. So every vote counts, and we're urging our people to come out and vote.
Fontaine says responses from the major political parties will be made available and also posted on the AFN website.
Meanwhile, in Wisconsin, a special group of tribal game wardens would be given similar powers to state officers under a plan advancing through the legislature. Wisconsin Public Radio's Sean Johnson reports.
The Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission, or GLIFWIC, has 20 wardens that patrol land once ceded by the Chippewa tribes in 3 states. 13 of those wardens work in Wisconsin. They're responsible for watching after Native Americans who hunt and fish off-reservation. But the commission's Jim Zorn says they often end up doing more.
Car accidents, heart attacks, delivering babies. You know, we've done it all.
But GLIFWIC officers are not offered the same types of protections as a state warden. Black River Falls Republican Terry Musser wants to change that.
There is a very good question whether, under state law, they can even go armed in uniform in a marked patrol vehicle. This calls into question just about every aspect of their work, and that just doesn't make sense.
A proposal Musser helped draft would spell out these rights, including when GLIFWIC officers can make arrests. It would also provide that if wardens are assaulted, they could charge their attackers with the same tough penalties as state police officers. Chief Warden Fred Molson says it will clear up any confusion when his officers are approaching people who might be breaking the law.
One thing that we were trained to do is to have our mind on the job, not things that can hinder us. And by having this bill passed, it can help us so we can do a better job and concentrate on what my officers and I can do.
The plan has already passed a pair of legislative committees. It now awaits action by the full state assembly and Senate. In Madison, Wisconsin, I'm Sean Johnson.
This is Independent Native News. I'm Robert Hannon.
Supported by Amerind Risk Management Corporation, a Native venture protecting Indian Country's assets. www.amerind-corp.org. Independent Native News is a production of KUAC at the University of Alaska Fairbanks.